wide for some soccer!
The San Jose Earthquakes present The Soccer Hour on KNBR 1050.
Brought to you exclusively by your NorCal Honda dealers.
Now here's your host, Ted Rainey.
All right, good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Soccer Hour on KNBR 1050, brought to you by your NorCal Honda dealers. I am on the mend from laryngitis, so while I sound good in the moment, it will only deteriorate more as I continue to talk, and I think you can already hear that happening as I'm continuing to speak. But I've got a great interview with Ryan O'Hanlon of ESPN to talk about what we've seen so far at the World Cup, mostly leading towards the U.S. men's. And then at the end, I am going to replay an interview of Farrell Walters we did from Santa Clara earlier in the season. Of course, Santa Clara's season came to an end the other night with their loss to Notre Dame. Hats off to Notre Dame. They played a great game. You can see why they're one of the best teams in the nation. And we'll hopefully be setting something up with their head coach, Jerry Smith, of the Broncos in the next week or so. Have a great holiday, everyone. Don't drink or drive. Hopefully on a week from now, my voice will be 100% and back to normal, and we can continue to have more great talks about what's already a very, very entertaining World Cup. All right, we are now joined on the Soccer Hour on KNBR 1050, brought to you by your NorCal Honda dealers, by our good friend Ryan O'Hanlon. Of course, you know him from ESPN, and we had him on about a month ago to talk about his new book, Net Gains, Inside the Beautiful Games Analytics Revolution. Ryan, what's going on, man? How are you doing?
I'm hanging in there. How are you?
I'm doing very well, man. It's fun watching all the things, just quickly it happened. Like, we had the opening day of the World Cup, and I think everybody kind of had the reaction of, this doesn't really feel like the World Cup because it's winter. And then all of a sudden we get to day two, and then it seemed like everything just since then has just been, S into the fan, splatter everywhere. It's just kind of been wild. Like, I woke up and I got an email that said the biggest World Cup upset ever, and I didn't think anything of it, and I thought it was going to talk about like past and present. And then I opened the email and I was like, oh, wow. Okay. So Argentina lost. So I was like, what the? And then this morning with Japan. And I mean, it's been wild. It's been fun, but it's been wild. You'll have to excuse me. I'm recovering from laryngitis, so my voice might prepubescently crack a couple more times. But it's been fun, though. I'll give it that much. It's just not at all what I've expected.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been, I think there's a lot of reasons to expect potentially some more weirdness from the games, just with it happening in the middle of the World Cup, kind of how crazy the soccer schedule has been since COVID. And then it's probably been even crazier in a lot of ways. I think Saudi Arabia beating Argentina is just like, I can't believe that sentence just came out of my mouth. Right. and then, Japan beats Germany a couple hours before we're talking. And that itself was its own sort of freakish game where Germany had, they had the most possession of any team in a loss other than Germany when they lost to South Korea in 2018. So a lot of incredibly stats wise, historic things that have happened. A lot of fun. It'll be interesting to see how it feels having the World Cup on an NFL Sunday. I think that's part of why the last one felt a little strange, but we're going to have a full day of four games this upcoming Sunday. And then obviously Thanksgiving, Black Friday, a lot of things we've never experienced before.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of one of the things that I was wondering about, the idea of how much do you think the results are being impacted by just it being not, it's not the typical international window, it's not, we're used to doing this in the summer. It's for a lot of teams, it's, during their seasons. I mean, wouldn't we expect the play to be higher? And is that maybe that why we are seeing some of these teams kind of play a little bit above their heads?
I think it's possible. Because the teams that are playing the most games are the teams that are in the Champions League, right? They've had extra games, and on average, the best teams at the World Cup have the most players that are playing on the best teams in the Champions League. Well, Saudi Arabia has essentially been practicing all season together. Qatar, same thing, didn't really work out for them. But at the same time, with soccer, I always try to take a step back and just think random stuff happens all the time. Argentina and Germany both drastically outplayed the teams that they lost to, in my opinion. So it's where the Saudi Arabia players better at kicking a ball. The two times they kicked a ball against Argentina, they had three shots. So I should say three. And then, you know, did Japan's keeper play amazing? Cause Germany's players are on Bayern Munich. You know what I mean? So when you kind of break it down, you know, I don't think it's like the full explanation, but I think it definitely plays a role. And I think we'll see some more weird stuff going forward.
Yeah.
Probably.
Do you think the weird stuff is good? I mean, cause I could understand why FIFA maybe might not like, so let's just say a major power doesn't get out of the group stage. Is that a good thing in your opinion? Or is that not good?
Yeah. I mean, major powers don't get out of the group, at least like one doesn't get out of the group at every tournament. But we've never seen that turn into, you know, an underdog making a run to the final. I guess Croatia kind of did in the last tournament, but like the history of the World Cup is there being upsets in the group stages, then the underdogs just getting absolutely annihilated in the group stages. So like, is that a good thing? I mean, it makes the group stages more exciting, but like, you know, would you rather see, sorry, my dog doesn't like upsets at all. I think he was good on our last chat. But would you rather see, you know, Saudi Arabia play like the Netherlands in the quarterfinals, or would you rather see Argentina play the Netherlands in the quarterfinals? Yeah. Like, probably, I think I'd rather see the latter. In some ways, I also feel like the level of play has maybe been a little lower than I'm used to seeing at the World Cup. That might just be because it's like so close to the club game that it's like hard for me to like. With the World Cup, you normally have like a month reset where it's like, okay, I forgot what it was like in the Champions League watching those teams. But now it's like I saw those games like a week ago, and now this is just clearly a different game. So. Yeah, I guess by me rambling suggests that I don't actually know whether I think it's good or bad.
Well, I mean, that's a fair answer because, I mean, it doesn't, you know, we're all watching things happen in real time. We don't know where any of this is going to go. But I feel like we could talk about the greater conversation across sports where, you know, the last couple of years, if we looked at NCAA basketball, it seems like we've seen more of the lower seeded teams have upsets and kind of make deeper runs. And I feel like it's that much harder to be dominant in sports than it ever was before. I don't think that's unique to soccer. I think we're just in an age of sports where the parity is so widespread that being tangibly better is harder than it's ever been before. And I mean, that could be anecdotal, but I feel like that's a relatively true statement.
I think I would agree. And I think it almost shows itself in like, so Saudi Arabia gets, I forget what the numbers exactly were because I've watched a million soccer games over the past 3 days, but they had three shots. Argentina had something like 20. Right. And I think in the past, like that would be this distribution of Argentina playing Saudi Arabia in like 1990, let's say.
Yeah.
But I think you could probably say that like executing on those shots, the Saudi Arabian players are more capable of executing on those shots than they would have been in 1990. Right. So like even the lesser off teams are more talented. So they're able to like, even if the like underlying performances are gap is roughly the same as it's always been, the like lesser teams in all sports have better players that in the individual moments are probably more capable of executing, I think, in a way that like, you know, in the 80s or whatever, like, I don't know, like, you know, Belmont or whatever is less capable of like going like 25 for 30 from three in a game and winning than they would have been. So I guess back then no one was shooting threes. So
yeah, well, I mean, that's the thing is like you look for, you know, there's more data to rely upon and there's just, I mean, I can't ever understate the power of the internet in terms of the sharing of sports information specifically, because there were people in country XYZ who now have access to videos and training techniques and things that simply weren't there. Even, you know, if we went back to 2006, I mean, that was really at the, when high speed was getting spread across everywhere and suddenly YouTube starts popping up. And I always look at that effect of kids watching highlights and suddenly they start trying to replicate skills. Whereas if you didn't have access to seeing that before, you didn't even think to try it. Whereas now kids do, but we can wax on this as long as we want. But let's talk US. What was your big takeaway out of that game? Because I was talking to your ESPN cohort, Kyle Bonagura, a couple weeks ago, and after the couple of friendlies, and he said my takeaway was the lack of offensive creation. He said this is a consistent issue for the United States. And I felt like watching that game, and I was like, I know Kyle somewhere is nodding watching this game. Was that your big takeaway, or what were you? Are you on the why didn't Reyna come in, or what was your big takeaway?
Yeah. First, I want to point out that the U.S. played Japan and Saudi Arabia in those friendlies, who are right? Clearly the two best teams at the World Cup. So we should actually reassess what those games meant to us instead of, I wrote a piece being like, these games were so bad that like they actually matter in terms of how we judge the U.S. But now looking back, you know, getting a point from Saudi Arabia and Japan's actually, you know, bodes well. I mean, I think like if I had to boil it down to one thing, and I kind of had to do this for work, I would say that, like, I don't know, the lack of a number nine just still is a pretty glaring thing to me. Like, you look, Sargent had a decent chance on a header, which he hadn't taken a shot for the U.S. over the past calendar year, hadn't attempted a single shot. Right. So that was an upgrade. And then he had some, you know, I guess, decent little hold-up play with Pulisic on the goal, where the ball kind of, I think it like hit him on the hip a little bit, but he did manage to like shift it onto Pulisic and let him get ahead of speed. But otherwise he just like wasn't, you know, you look at like the pass maps for the game and it's like this little tiny dot for Josh Sargent. And then it's just an extreme collection of passes between all the other players. Cause in the first half, the US, like, they looked like a good club team does. Yeah. Like they pressed super high. They had some really nice like rotations between the wingers and midfielders and fullbacks, but it just like, it didn't, they got the goal out of it and they created one really good chance, but like they probably should have created a lot more from all the sort of territorial dominance they had. And then in the second half, I think you can kind of throw the same criticism at it, because like the second half was weird to me because it was like they were in between like pressing and sitting back and countering, which like you want to commit to one or the other, right? Because you're like, if you're going to press, okay, you risk the space in behind, but like then you at least create a couple turnovers high up the field. Or if you defend deep and counter, you make it harder for them to get the ball into your box, and then you create all this space to run into. And the US was kind of between the two. But I think like to counter, you need, you know, three guys that can just like combine quickly and create something out of nothing. And most of the counters for the U.S. was Pulisic and Wea, and then Josh Sargent was just like ineffective. So I think that, like, if that is the biggest kind of question mark to me, is there was no production from arguably the most important position in international soccer for the U.S., which is, seems like
is this your way of saying that you know, where's Pepe?
I don't think Pepe, to me, like, I thought Jesus Ferreira was relatively competent in qualifying. Yeah. He never had games where he disappeared. The main thing people were mad about with Ferreira was him not finishing the chances, but at least he got the chances, and he's much more like, he's always on the getting on the ball and helping create for teammates. Yeah. And I don't know what's going on with the team, but it's a little strange to me that like Ferreira became the starter in qualifying, right? Was the starter. Then there were no competitive games played for like 5 months. Sargent played two games and didn't attempt a shot. Haji Wright like was barely in the picture. And then all of a sudden Ferreira doesn't play a minute at the World Cup, and Sargent and Haji Wright are both in. So I found that to be a little strange. And I think, there were rumors of Tim Wea potentially starting up top.
Yeah.
This way you can get another one of your, just if you're going off of like FIFA ratings, right? Get all your highest FIFA rated guys in there. Then you have room for either Aronson or Reyna. And like the production from the center forward position was so absent that like, how could it be worse playing a winger at a position at that position? I feel like it would probably be better.
Well, I actually expected to see more of Pulisic dropping in underneath to help out. And actually he often attacked from the wing, which I thought they were going to bring the fullback out wide, drop Pulisic underneath and kind of do more of that. And they didn't. I mean, that was the thing that I was kind of expecting.
Other than when they scored the goal, you know, other than when they scored the goal,
well, right.
That was the only time.
Yeah. That was the only time. And that was what it was kind of like. I feel like you want to give more opportunities to Pulisic, because like you talked about, if you know, you give him space to run, like when he've had, and he's had these moments with Chelsea, it's been him, you know, just in space, creating something, cutting inside, drawing defenders. And you know, the timing on that pass was perfect. I mean, that's the thing. It's like you saw a blueprint and then you wonder, where is that the rest of the time? And it just didn't happen. And then, you know, there's the Jordan Morris question and Gio Reyna. I think the hate against him, I don't know. I mean, maybe Greg Berhalter said, I want to keep Reyna fresh for a start. Jordan Morris has also played in some big games and has had some big moments in big games. He might have been trying to lean on that as well. I didn't think it was as crazy controversial as some people did. But I, you know, I'm a Jordan Morris fan. I watched him, you know, since he was at Stanford. He's got a good game that I think translates to the international level.
Yeah, I mean, Berhalter said that he wanted someone, I guess, a little faster and more powerful just because he felt like that space was there at that stage of the game, which I think is a reasonable thing to say. It is a little weirder that Berhalter was kind of like, you know, suggested that they didn't think Reyna was like fully up to speed, but Reyna after the game said he was 100% healthy. And then Tyler Adams kind of had some strange comments, like, we know he can help the team or whatever. So that was weird. Like, that's just galaxy braining it way too much, like not playing Reyna. Like, he's clearly one of the 11 best players if he's healthy. But yeah, the Pulisic thing is interesting. I don't know. It's like, in some ways, Pulisic has looked the best for the U.S. when he was playing under Bruce Arena and was just like that qualifying run where the U.S. didn't qualify, but he came in sort of toward the beginning and just played as like a 10 and was like creating goals, scoring goals, like left and right. Basically, he looked incredible. But now, you know, the U.S. just by choice is kind of trying to like play like a club team in some ways, like, you know, tactics are what, you know, formations in soccer are, you know, essentially meaningless in some ways. But like, if you kind of break it down, right, like playing a 4-3-3 theoretically would create more attacking juice for your team because it's, you know, three attackers then two midfielders ahead of a defensive midfielder. And then if you get your fullbacks forward, that's just more players forward. While a 4-2-3-1, that's only technically four players ahead of the ball. But in some ways, I think like a 4-2-3-1 is just a more, it's an easier way to play because the roles are more, are just clearer. Yeah. Like in a 4-3-3, those wingers, like you're saying, Pulisic has to kind of play in the like hybrid winger / attacking midfielder role. There has to be a lot of like rotations and stuff like that, where like the U.S. had a ton of the ball against Wales, right? But it seemed so hard for them to turn all that possession into good chances. While the one time they kind of got the ball in space or a semi-transition moment, it seemed so easy for them to create a chance, right? Pulisic just had to like make a great run, and he also had a really nice like, he kind of took a couple touches a little bit to the right and kind of drew the center backs toward him and then slipped the ball through, and that was great. So I think really, I think ideally you would be creating as many of those potential moments as possible, but that's instead it was more, you know, like have to do like seven really difficult things in a row to even get like a decent attempt on goal. So
yeah, I mean, just it's frustrating just because the first half was dominated by the U.S. I mean, they really, really just were everywhere, and to walk away with one goal out of all those, all that possession, I think that's what U.S. fans are focusing on. So I mean, how does what we have seen and knowing how physical that game was and know what they're up against England, how does this look to you? I mean, what does the U.S. have to do? I know that England is a team that is, I mean, they are looking at this as generational, but at the same time, English fans feel like every team is generational. So, you know, it's hard to separate the hyperbole from the reality. Either way, it's a tough challenge for the U.S.
Yeah, well, Harry Kane is potentially injured, which I would say England's depth is among all, they have a ton of attacking talent, but at the number nine, that's where their drop off from Kane to the next guy is a huge drop off. So that if he doesn't play, if he's not fully fit, that's a boon for the U.S., makes them more likely to pull something out of it. I don't think that they'll, I don't know. I don't see a situation where a world where they play the first half in the same way they played against Wales. Like, I don't see them pinning England into their own third and like not giving up any shots and just like dominating possession. I don't see that. So perhaps in some ways that like bodes a little bit better potentially. I think there will be more space for Pulisic to like get up ahead of steam, I think. At least there should be. But they're just going to have a lot less of the ball. And I think like they defended okay in the second half. Like they defended poorly in terms of like keeping the ball out of their defensive third, but like they gave up the big chances they gave up were like just crosses into the box and then just a terrible decision by Walker Zimmerman to attempt to slide for that ball. So, you know, it's tough. Like the talent gap is just huge still between the US and England. Like they're not, there's no position where the US has better players. Like fullback, you could maybe like try to convince me that it's somewhat close, but they're just out talented at every position. So like, I don't know. I think it's like, you don't want to say, like, I hate to like, I feel like I've been constantly leaning toward like, well, the US is like better equipped to play against teams that are better than the US, because then it's going to force them to play on the counterattack, which like, that's not a thing that I should say. But, you know, I think if the US goes into this game knowing they have to kind of sit deep and defend and then try to counter, like, I think that that's, you know, that's the recipe, right, of underdogs in the history of soccer. And like right. The US has, like, it's, there's nothing wrong with defending and countering when you have more talented players than you had in the past. You're then more likely to create more from those counterattacks, and you're probably more likely to defend better in those situations, I think, in a lot of ways.
No, I mean, it makes sense because, I mean, the other thing about sitting back and countering, and like you alluded to, when you switch from a 4-3-3 to a 4-2-3-1, your role becomes that much more defined. And then with the US in terms of some of the extreme athletes they have, then you know, get them out in space, get them in transition, you run the counter and things happen. I mean, that's yep. The best part about playing that style of soccer is that when you do get guys on their heels, when you do make the defenders have to make quick emergency decisions, like you're asking questions of that back line that are a little bit different than, hey, we're going to play the possession game and build it up and we're going to get our cross or our cutback. It's like, you know what's going to happen in an attack in soccer in a traditional sense. And it's on the counter and everybody's scrambling around trying to figure out who they're defending and where guys are. And suddenly there's overlaps. That's where space opens up. And that's where the US's biggest problem was, is they would get to the final third and they couldn't define the space that they wanted to go to from there. It would stall every single time. They would try a cross, like you alluded to a couple of weeks ago, saying the crosses don't really work. Every single cross they tried, it felt like it was blocked.
Yeah. The crossing was, that was brutal.
Brutal.
In the second half, just like completely hopeless every cross, especially since it was like a bunch of tiny little like attacking midfielder wingers that the US has versus like Wales' three gigantic center backs. But yeah, I think you're right. I think you're like, it's, you know, it certainly clarifies your roles. And I think it's just like a lot of these players, like for the US, are guys that were came up through the Bundesliga or played in the Red Bull system, mm-hmm. played for Borussia Dortmund, and they're used to doing stuff in transition. Obviously they're used to like defending a lot higher because of those, the way, you know, Red Bull and the Jesse Marsch teams have played in Borussia Dortmund, but like they've like flourished in space in their careers. So I think like it fits a lot of what they do. And I think like, I don't know, I think that there's like there's like pressing high and then there's defending deep. And it's sometimes treated like those are just the only two things. And there's no like
in between,
there's like, you know, millions of things in between. Like even like Saudi Arabia, they drew Argentina offside 10 times in that game. So they like defended, but they defended in a different way. So like the US can defend, they don't have to defend in their box the entire game, right? They can set a line on the edge of their penalty area and defend a little higher. And like, even if they don't have a ton of the ball, they can still like hold on to possession for some of their possessions, right? Like they don't have to, you know, you try to, if you see the space to create a counterattack, you go for it. But if you win the ball back and there's no space, the team is capable of like passing the ball around in a way that they haven't been in the past. So I think that there's like a room for both of those things. And say they get the first goal, there's probably even more room for them to like hang onto the ball a little more and use defensive possession. So I feel like we're like talking ourselves into like the US winning or something based on this conversation by accident. But like, I think their goal, right, they're going to get outshot by England. Like that's just should be what we expect to have happen.
Yeah.
And England's probably going to have more of the ball, but I think it's like limit the number of shots and limit the quality of shots. And then for yourself, you want to like ensure that the shots you're creating are high quality shots, right? I think is kind of, should be the realistic game plan for the US.
What do you think of Tyler Adams alluding to Reyna can help us and Reyna saying that he's 100% fit? Does that speak of what's going on in that, you know, dressing room or locker room right now? We can galaxy brain our way into overthinking every single thing, but I mean, that's not exactly a united front.
Yeah. And one thing that like has been true about the Berhalter reign, despite all the criticisms that people have, is like that part of it has not been an issue. It seems like it's been a very united team. I don't want to read into it too much, but it is strange for a coach to say, well, we're kind of like, you know, he didn't say that Reyna didn't play because he wasn't fit, but he also said like that he wasn't fully fit. And then Reyna himself was like, I'm 100% healthy. So obviously like in sports, like athletes are constantly telling us that they're healthy when they're like, not at all. I feel like J.K. Dobbins, the Ravens running back, like guaranteed he would be playing in game one of the season, like during preseason, and he's played like one game so far this year. So like, that's a common thing, but I think it's still a kind of a strange discrepancy. I don't know. You just gotta like, coach, this happens in every sport. Like one of the things in my book that this guy, Luke Bourne, who is a co-owner at AC Milan and Toulouse, he said one of the biggest issues with like being a sort of analytical decision maker is making sure that the best players on the team play. And like, you see it with every sport, like coaches have their sort of systems, right? And they frequently prioritize the systems more than the talent that they're given. And like, Gio Reyna is clearly one of the 11 best players at the World Cup for the US. And like, you're just trying to win these games. There's no like, let's build for the future, let's figure out our system. It's like, you just need to win these games. So I think like, I don't know, if he doesn't play the next game or doesn't play a significant amount in the next game, that's just, you know, you're just wasting a shot at, you know, maximizing your potential at this tournament.
Well, Ryan, I know you've got a busy schedule, so I will let you go. Obviously, people can get your book, Net Gains Inside the Beautiful Games Analytics Revolution. I know you said that you can get it anywhere you get books, but as you alluded to last time, you like your independent bookstores. But also, people can get all your stuff. Go to the soccer tab on ESPN. They can find your work there as well.
Yep. Perfect. Enjoyed it. Thanks for having me.
Right on, Ryan. Appreciate your time. And, I made good on my promise to bug you again. And I've done that once. And I promise you I'll bug you again a second time.
Bug away. Keep it coming.
Again, that is Ryan O'Hanlon of ESPN joining us here on the Soccer Hour on KMBR 1050. Because I am dealing with some laryngitis, I am giving you a best of interview. We talked to Farrah Walters of Santa Clara earlier in September. I thought it was a good interview that you guys would like to hear once again. Again, have a great holiday, everyone. I'll see you on the other side. All right, welcome back to the Soccer Hour on KMBR 1050, brought to you by your NorCal Honda dealers. We are now joined by Farrah Walters of the Santa Clara Broncos. Farrah, what's going on? How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing very well, and I was just riffing with you beforehand. You're from Arizona, so, you know, being here in the Bay Area as of late, you must have thought you were maybe getting some, you know, more chill summer environs, but you've not gotten that so far.
No, last week was crazy. I thought I was in Arizona again, for sure.
Did you guys have to switch your training to the mornings or anything? Because I know that a lot of programs, depending on the sport, did actually. So,
well, one time last week, we actually had to cancel training because it was just too hot. But that was like the only day that it really affected us. Besides then, like, we normally practice like 10 o'clock-ish. So it doesn't really affect us too much. But yeah.
That's cool. Yeah. No, I mean, that's it's an outdoor sport, you know, it's what you got to deal with. I was talking to Stanford men's head coach Jeremy Gunn last week, and he said that no matter how hot it is, he's still good at yelling at his players. I imagine Jerry is very much in the same vein. He's still able to yell at you guys during practice.
Yeah, but he's not much of a yeller, so it's
I know, the guy is so supremely chill. Like, let's talk about that angle. You come to Santa Clara, and I was talking to him right after he won the national championship a couple years ago, and I was saying, like, man, this broadcast is like the greatest recruiting video that you could have ever made. Like, they're showing you, they've got your former players and national team members in the audience. Like, how much of the just overall the legacy of Santa Clara played into you deciding to come here?
Well, I committed here when I was 14 years old, and I started actually like thinking about Santa Clara in college when I was in eighth grade, and just talking to them and coming to campus, I just knew I wanted to go here because he's just so intelligent, and it's not like a show he puts on, because that's exactly how he is, like in the mm-hmm. film room, and like when you're just having a normal conversation with him. So it's just super cool, and I'm definitely learning so much here.
So you committed when you were 14?
Yeah, I did.
Okay, because I remember seeing the letter of intent stuff that went out last year, so I didn't know that it was that it had been that long. So that's awesome, A. And then B, like, this is the thing that I always wonder is, like, when do you start realizing that you can take these aspirations beyond like playing for a club and being like a high school athlete? Because, you know, for me, like, my best sport was track and field. It was pretty clear that that was not going to go beyond high school. So I just, you know, for you to be 14, be like, oh, I'm going to go to one of the premier programs in the nation. Like, how did that become so clear? Like, was it the fact that, you know, I know you did stuff with the U15s. Like, was that just kind of all in the picture at that point?
I think so. I think it was kind of just always there. And like my club team, like they had taken everybody to college and everybody had kind of gone to college with them. So it's just something that kind of came naturally, I feel like. And then this was kind of before the rule change. So like committing earlier was kind of more common, even though I did commit even earlier, like when the rules were like that. But yeah, it was just always in the picture for me. And since I was a little girl, I always wanted to play college soccer, especially for a top program.
Yeah, no, and obviously Santa Clara, a good place to come and do so. How has your adjustment to the Bay Area been?
It's definitely an adjustment, but I love it. And I'm just learning so much, like I said. And if I want to go to the next level, which I do past college, then it's just another step in my life that I have to take. And I'm loving every moment of it and trying to soak everything up here.
So. In terms of kind of adjusting to that college life and being able to, you know, just work on your athletics. I mean, I know that obviously you're a student athlete, clearly. I'm not going to try and pretend that you're not. But I mean, when you're able to kind of focus that much more on being the student athlete as before, when you're in high school, there's so many distractions and you're trying to get to that next level. And now you kind of, even though you've got a lot going on, it's still, I imagine, it makes things a little bit easier. It allows you to narrow your focus.
For sure. And since we're a quarter system here, we haven't actually started school. So we start next week. And that kind of is awesome because we can really focus on soccer in that transition. And then next week we'll add in school, which is going to be a little bit more smoother, I think, than just having school and soccer right off the bat together.
Yeah. How is the competition level at the collegiate level compared to what you've been doing before? Like, was it an immediate eye-opening? Did that happen at practice initially, or did that not happen until you got into games?
So I've been with like the national team stuff. So I've kind of been exposed to higher level games and trainings before, but it's always just like the next step up. And like, I think it really hit me when I first went into my first game, you know, and I just realized, okay, this is next level and it's just faster. Everybody's amazing. And yeah, it's just different for sure.
I guess the one thing that I've heard from a lot of players is that they realize when they make that next jump to whatever level it is that how much more quick they have to be with that first touch out of pressure, that it comes very, very quickly. Was that how it was for you?
100%. Yeah. It kind of takes a minute to get your touch and your confidence back, but you just have to adjust. And yeah.
So you're coming off two games ago in which you recorded a hat trick. I know that in the post game interview on, I think it was on the Broncos social, you said that you'd had one of those before, but I imagine that's probably got to be a pretty good feeling to do it at the collegiate level.
Oh, it felt so amazing. And just with Izzy scoring the first goal as well, like I was just so excited because we needed that. And she did amazing. I was super excited to be involved in that. So yeah, it was awesome.
In terms of like the chemistry out there with all your teammates, like obviously you're still building it. The season's, you know, you're not too deep into it. Everybody's still getting to know each other. Like, does it feel like everything's trending in the right direction?
100%. And everybody on that field is an excellent player. And it's just so nice to be able to rely on your teammates and for them to rely on you as well. And it's just, I think it's really good chemistry on this team for sure. And off the field as well. Like, typically you see it on the field, but we're just best friends off the field as well. So it's really cool.
That's cool. Have you played with any of your teammates currently before at any camps or any national team stuff?
I played with Annie Carrick and also Colby Barnett at some national team camps. But besides that, no, I haven't.
That's cool. So in terms of that, like getting to know everybody, like have you, in your previous experience, like, is there like a certain point where like if you feel it happens after, you know, however many games, or is it just kind of each individual person, you kind of get to know their game a little bit differently?
A little bit of both. I think once you get one game under your belt, like you kind of earn like some respect, and like also just like it takes your like relationship to the next level because you're in a game, like practice, you're playing against each other, but together for games, you're like going against a different team. So it takes a little bit of a different like perspective, and I don't know, just kind of different, I guess.
Were there any of your new teammates who you gelled with quicker than others?
I don't honestly think so. Obviously, like my roommate, Annie, I've known her for a few years, and knowing like coming into this, we knew we were going to be here together, but I'm like best friends with everybody. So I think it's like all the same around.
So here's the player's question. Are you more happy with the hat trick the other day, or are you more angry about the loss on Sunday?
Being a competitive person, I'm probably more angry about the loss for sure. But yeah, I'm still happy with the hat trick. So
yeah, I mean, it's cool. But yeah, you give the same answer that every athlete, no matter the sport, it's like you can talk about the great thing that happened previously, but the loss always seems to be much more to the top of the mind. And then you've got a big game coming up on Sunday against Stanford. You know, this is obviously two of the local powers. In terms of you kind of getting up for that, do you treat it more of like a rivalry game, or do you think more of it is like, nah, I can't take this, you know, differently than any other game?
For me personally, every game I play, I try to just do my best and give everything for the team. So it's going to be like just another game for me since I'm a freshman. I have never played Stanford. So I'm just going to go out there and do what I can do for the team and hope we get the result that we're looking for.
Has Jerry talked about it at all? Has he tried to say anything about it, or is he just trying to play it cool?
It's so early on in the week, so we're just focusing on ourselves right now and preparing and doing what we can do best and kind of just focusing on that.
You've obviously got a little bit of a break in the schedule, whereas, you know, it'd been a little bit more rapid fire before this. Like, how does this week kind of set up now for you guys preparing for your next opponent?
We're probably going to be grinding for the next couple of days. And as the week goes on, we'll kind of chill out a little bit, kind of depending on our loads and stuff like that. So, yeah.
So like, there's no like immediate thing. He's not working on specific, like, this is what they do, this is how we have to respond to it. It's kind of just more like get in the work and then taper that down, maybe as the game prep kind of tapers up.
I think with any team, we're always like talking about them and knowing their strengths and throughout the whole entire week. So yeah, he definitely is talking about that, and we're definitely having that in the back of our minds for sure, even in the beginning of the week.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit more about Coach Smith, because he's just, you know, in my experiences with him, just the coolest guy. Obviously, he's just always, I mean, he's got the reputation he does for a reason. Was it hard to kind of, you know, get to used to his personality? Is it hard to get like kind of on par with everything? Because, you know, I imagine there's just, you know, when you go from working with somebody every day, like suddenly you have to learn about how they kind of implement what they want you to do, how they're going to coach you individually on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, for sure. I think coming from club to college is a transition no matter what, but Coach Jerry is just a very lovable guy. Like, there's nothing to not like about him. And he's just, like I said, very intelligent and wise, and there's always something to learn from him on or off the field. So it's been really cool to experience that.
Does his wife ever come out to practice?
Oh yeah, Brandy's out there quite a bit. I love her too.
That is so cool. That's obviously, we talk about the marketing campaign that is the existence of Santa Clara soccer. And it's like, he's just walking, you know, you got Jerry walking around and Brandy's walking around. It's like, yeah, this is pretty cool. And I work with Danielle Slayton at the Earthquake, so I get to hear her side of it. And, you know, like, it's like, again, like every time during their run a couple of years ago, you know, it was just, you're seeing all these great names that are associated with the program. I mean, do you feel that pressure because there are so many big names associated with the Broncos?
I honestly don't think so, just because I know, like, and we trust our coaches and preparing us, and we're just trusting the process. It's a long 4 years, and you never know how you're going to come outside of this program, but you're going to be doing something great, because look at our history with all these legendary people who've gone through this program. So it's kind of exciting, and yeah, I love it.
In terms of the early season results that you guys have had so far, I mean, how do you feel about what's happened out there on the pitch?
I'm really excited, because every training session we're improving, and we just got to get the result now. And I think we're in a really good direction, or headed in a really good direction, and it's excited.
What do you want to work on in your game? Like, now that you've kind of maybe gotten to know things a little bit better within, you know, Jerry's system, what are you looking at your own game and saying, I need to work on this, that, or the other thing? Or do you always kind of look at your game? It's not maybe broken down into individual pieces. You kind of just want to keep on raising the bar.
I think a little bit of both. For me personally, I think it's more the tactical side, and like my runs, and just like doing film work and working on that side, because I'm an athletic person. So I have that, like, but I just want to work on my skill more, and just like the tactical part, understanding like my teammates and how they work and stuff like that.
When you watch soccer, are you able to remove yourself from the tactical side of things? Are you always like, are you identifying the triangle? Are you looking at what they're doing in a 4-2-3-1 or a 4-3-3? Are you able to remove you? Cause like, I've spent nearly a decade broadcasting soccer now. And like, I used to be able to watch it and like have fun, but now I'm like way too in on it. And I'm just like, it's like I'm preparing every time I'm watching it. Is that part of your life as well now?
Yeah, definitely. I can't probably like disassociate myself anymore. Yeah. I just look at it as a tactical standpoint and trying to learn something always whenever I'm watching. So yeah.
Yeah. Who, like, are you watching any NWSL? Are you watching MLS, EPL? Like, where are you usually watching your soccer?
I love to watch the NWSL, especially Kelsey Turnbow right now. It's super cool that she came from this program. Alex Morgan, of course, just Sophia Smith. I love watching Mal Pugh as well. Mm-hmm. So those are some top players I'm inspired by.
Yeah, Kelsey, I interviewed Kelsey last year after she got drafted, and especially like you go back to her goal in the national championship game, like that was the definition of a touch of class, and it's very cool to watch her now, you know, playing with San Diego. But that's one of the things, and it's, you know, you look at Danielle Slayton, what she's trying to do and bring NWSL to the Bay Area. Like, are you amazed that there is not a program here already? Because I, like, my dad used to broadcast the Cyber Rays back in the day. I'm from a broadcast family. We're good at talking, nothing else. But he broadcast the Cyber Rays in addition to doing the Quakes Clash, what they were in the late 90s. So, like, I was used to, you know, going to those games when I was 17 years old, and, you know, going out and watching Brandy and everybody else. And like, I'm amazed this is the Bay Area and we don't have the NWSL as a franchise here. Like, to me, it's stunning.
Yeah, we need a team out here for sure.
Yeah, no, it'd be cool, especially because we look at all the great talent that comes out of here. It's like, it'd be cool if they were here representing the Bay Area. But, you know, that's another conversation we can have for another time. But I guess, you know, just what's next for you this year? Like, is it now just trying to integrate the Scholastic side of things with the school starting up and just keep it rolling? Is it still an adjustment period for you overall?
Oh yeah, for sure. Especially because I'm just a couple games in as a freshman, and I just want to be able to multitask school and soccer and continue to get better in both areas of my life, and hopefully make a deep run into the tournament for sure.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Farrah. I appreciate your time. More hat tricks. That'll be my one request, because those are always fun. But again, I appreciate your time and everything that's going to come from you in the future. All right.
Thank you so much.
Again, that was a replay of our interview with Farrah Walters of the Santa Clara Broncos. We're out of time for tonight. Thank you for bearing with me and my dodgy voice. I will see you next week. For the San Jose Earthquakes, Andrew NorCal Honda Dealers, I'm Ted Ramey signing off.
This has been the Soccer Hour with Ted Ramey, presented by the San Jose Earthquakes and your local NorCal Honda Dealers on KNBR 1050, the sports leader.
The countdown is on for the 2024 NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, live from Detroit, and you can attend in person for free.
Welcome to the NFL Draft.
See the next NFL stars and experience the ultimate NFL fan festival, featuring live concerts, interactive games, player autographs, and more. The NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, April 25th through 27th. Visit NFL.com/draftaccess to register for free entry today.